Okay, we're back after lunch. And I think we've got you to Utah, and you're kind of getting an idea about your obligations there in terms of teaching. And
So this is a reminder that Kay gave me.
Okay.
Which was listing of teaching courses and things. Boards and fellowships, professional societies, not it.
But I mean, you really weren't a big time teacher, so to speak.
Oh, no, never big time. If I spent 8 hours a week on it, or in a week, that would, to me, be pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
I ran the seminar program for the Department of Medicinal Chemistry for some years. 5 years, I guess. And the course, there's a multi-departmental course called Biomedical Research Techniques, and I developed that and learned that for probably 10 years here since 84 to 86, if that's not good.
A lot of extracurricular stuff.
Oh, I mean, modest amount. I was a departmental graduate advisor for the graduate students, all graduate students, from 82 to 2004.
Oh, wow.
That's a long time.
That's a lot of advising.
Methods in Structural Biology was a multi-department course that I developed and taught in between 92 and 2006. And medicinal chemistry 656 was a mass biomedical applications of mass spectrometry. That was between 76 and 2006. So that's not a lot of teaching in a certain sense, but it lasted for some years.
It seemed like it was a lot related to mass spec and interpretation of
biomedical applications of mass spectrometry. Now that's a whole course on mass spectrometry. But biochemistry 649, methods in structural biology, that included X-ray crystallography and NMR and all of that. And I would get different people in to talk about those things. So I was the manager of the course. So forth. It was for 8, 6, 14 years. Kay may want to tell you some things about making changes in here.
Well, that's, we can certainly cover that
based on what you sent her. You like to steer?
Well, let's talk about your students at Utah. You were able to get funding right away, pretty much, and with that you were able to get an equipment, a 110, and you were able to get some students, I guess. What kind of students were going to this? Is a school of This is a School of Pharmacy?
In the School of Pharmacy, but all the graduate students, really, most of them are chemists. They're not. Pharmacists are rare and usually don't have the background. So students, my students, I would normally have one or two at a time, and that's not a lot.
So how did they find you? I mean, you're in pharmacy.
Well, the population of them in the department, and they interview faculty to see what the story would be if they worked for them. What would they do? What's up? And so you make a spiel to them, and they then make a decision about who they want to work with. Of course, you've got to make sure you have the money to support them for years. There was that sort of thing.
So mostly, you're kind of in a cross-disciplinary area here. You're in analytical chemistry, chemistry, biology.
Yeah.
Now your research is still in nucleosides and nucleotides, right?
Well, nucleic acids.
Nucleic acids.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
so they come to you because they want to do that? They know you're known for that?
They come to me. Some of it is that, yes, it turns out, I was told by them. And some of it was mass spectrometry. And if they had an involvement with mass spectrometry, for example, as an undergraduate, they worked somewhere and ran samples, they said, God, this is pretty neat stuff.
Yeah.
So that would take that tack. Otherwise, if it was the biological part, they would not know much about it. Let's see, missing pieces here. I was director of the mass spectrometry facility for the University of Utah from 1976 to 2003. Okay, that is a campus-wide.
So you had equipment, obviously you ended up with more than the 110.
Not mine. No, this equipment is not mine.
This is
university money.
Okay.
I made sure that I didn't use any of my equipment for that.
But did you? Were you the arbiter as to which to buy?
I was, and I would make the rules about what samples are submitted, and we charge them. Most things are never free.
Mm-hmm.
They can be free if it helps,
mm-hmm.
but there's mostly not, and so there would be a fee schedule that I would have to keep up year after year. And then there was the interdepartmental. I'm looking at this thing I haven't seen before. Interdepartmental biological chemistry program. That's where it goes through 20 some odd departments, I think.
Oh boy.
27, 28 departments. So I was the director of that from 93 to 95. All other things kind of fall out from those. Visiting professor, visiting investigator. The National Cancer Center Research Institute, that's to work with Susumu Nishimura. And I had the title of a visiting investigator between 71 and 92. Okay, so that's...
You made a lot of visits?
21 years. Well, I made probably a dozen. So the advantage in that, if you're going to Japan, is that it's a remarkable thing to see it change. Just it. Every year, every other year, you see changes.
So when you say changes, is that what?
The buildings, the dress, the things that represent societal.
So they're becoming more westernized in dress?
To some extent, but otherwise just better at what they do, more sophisticated trappings of this and that.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand it's a very dense population in Tokyo.
Very dense.
So was that an issue? I mean, did that kind of feel...
It did originally, and the bigger problem there was taking the public transportation. When I went for 6 months, first time to work for Susumu Nishimura, that's when I had a NIH fellowship I took public transportation. That's an hour and a half each way. Each way. And sometimes you couldn't stand, you couldn't move your arms on a train. You could not move your arms. So this comes to some, leaves you with some hilarious situations sometimes when you're boxed in tightly. I'll describe this more tonight at dinner. Anyway, so, but I got used to that and being stared at. You're the only foreigner on the whole train. The whole train.
Yeah.
There are 1,000 people on that train.
Yeah.
So you have a feeling of...
Who's the oddball?
Being gawked at is a better word than just that. So, let's see. Is this? I do not know where the demon thing is, Kay. You said this.
What?
Printed, the demon.
I didn't say it was printed.
Oh.
I said you were looking at it this morning.
Oh, on the.
On my computer right here.
Oh.
Was it in a paper thing?
No, say? I can find it if I just sit here for a minute.
Okay.
We need to find just a break and what we're doing.
It was the last of the text.
Oh, the text.
Okay.
So these students that you did get...
Yeah, backgrounds, mostly in chemistry.
Chemistry.
Yeah. And I had a total, while being at the University of Utah, of what, about six, I guess, my whole career at the University of Utah. Six graduate students, and another five from Baylor. The rest are all postdocs.
Ah, okay.
So one could take a slice of population and be, at any one time, maybe one or two graduate students. And I had graduate students from biochemistry, too, biochemistry department. So I was also professor of biochemistry.
Okay.
And that was, I always thought it was a generous thing on their part.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved there, there was a deal made about me having an appointment in medical school.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pre-concocted deal.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went there, I thought the worst thing is for me to walk in the door and announce what I'm doing. And so I didn't. And I went to see these guys, and they said, well, why don't you hang around for a year, see how things are going, and then we'll talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I did that, and they voted, I guess, and I became then professor of biochemistry. So I became professor of biochemistry for a few days. A year after I got there, because I didn't rush into it, even though the deal had been prearranged. And so...
so this was a medical, on a medical school faculty?
Well, there's both, because if, as professor of biochemistry, that's in the medical school. Professor of medicinal chemistry is in the College of Pharmacy.
Oh, wow.
So I was in two departments, in two colleges, that's in two different buildings. But I got a lot of intellectual benefit from the biochemistry department, much more than other places. So I had students from there, and I went to their seminars, and all the full trappings of the biochemistry department.
Yeah.
And that was enjoyable.
Yeah, so generally speaking, getting any degree of recognition in the medical school is difficult compared to, you know, I mean, that was the way it is at Washington University. If you have a joint appointment and you're able to have one of your appointments in the medical school, then that's super good.
yeah.
You know, for, is it the same way at Utah that that you got extra credit?
Somewhat, yeah. I would say so.
So you continued to focus on the nucleotides-nucleosides work research.
So that developed along...
You're kind of learning a lot about chemistry.
Increasingly, biological lines and also things related to evolution.
Yep.
Because, as as I mentioned to you before, the world is divided into three compartments for evolution. Archaea, Reptilia, and Eukaryotes.
Mm-hmm.
We are Eukaryotes.
Yeah.
And it turned out that a lot of characteristics of modification of nucleic acids is unique to one or to two, sometimes three, mm-hmm. sometimes one, sometimes two, of those domains. And so we kept up with those, and we published pictures showing what was in which domain.
So this is kind of like an overarching guidance to your research?
Well, we're interested in what's unique to this, what's mm-hmm. unique to that. But the main driving force was when we started working on high-temperature organisms.
And when was that? That was with this fellow, Stetter?
Stetter. And part of it was with him, and part of it just was me doing stuff on my own without his... The very first, it was in about 85.
And this is the...
So let's say 85, 86.
Okay.
Would be the opening gun on that count.
By this time, how many other people were doing mass spec of nucleotides? Or was there anybody?
Well, it depends on how what your level of seriousness would be in order to designate that. But I think there were never more than half a dozen. At one time, it became fashionable to think you could sequence nucleic acids by mass spectrometry.
Right.
And they were interested mainly in DNA, because mm-hmm. that was a goal sure. of mine if it worked.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work. I never said it worked. In fact, I was interviewed by CNN News and quoted that in there that it was destined not to work, that was not a way that it was going to be
mm-hmm.
fruitful
mm-hmm.
for large-scale sequencing.
Mm-hmm.
The RNA or DNA,
mm-hmm.
and it turned out to be true. So once those people dropped out, those are the ones who would drop in when you can get involved with DNA for a couple of years and find out it wasn't getting them anywhere, so they back out maybe. And so, let's see, beyond that, you had some things like, we published it at the same time Hillenkamp did on some things. His interest was never that much into nucleic acids, but he published a paper or two,
mm-hmm.
and so forth.
So it's, I mean, you're kind of like a lone wolf up in this area.
To some extent, yeah. Over a period of time, I may have been just about the only person. And I became the only person really working to look at these modifications. There are other angles you can pursue. The one of making modifications on RNA.
Mm-hmm.
DNA instructs the cell what the sequence is going to be of proteins and of RNA.
Okay.
So there are separate genes for those
mm-hmm.
two. And once the RNA is made, it is then, most of the RNAs have been subject to further modification. Methylation, replacement of O by S, side chains of various kinds,
mm-hmm.
and special enzymes that do that. Just in RNA. And so when you get to that level and you're worrying about where they're coming from and so forth, I may have been about the only person, certainly the only one doing mass spectrometry. There may have been a few people along the way, mm-hmm. but not. It wasn't that it was a great idea of mine that made it so, but it was true that I spent a lot of time finding out how to do it.
Knowing
these people
mm-hmm.
and so forth, that made it a fruitful avenue of research.
Were there was there difficulties in actually getting these guys to fly?
Not after you had things like electrospray. And what I started to say earlier was that what really uncorked the dam was LCMS with electric spray. That was the greatest single moving event, because you could take nucleic acids and you could hydrolyze them down to small pieces and analyze the whole thing in one shot, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a typical advantage of chromatography, mass spectrometry. Mm-hmm. Same thing would hold for GCMS. Only in this case, you're working with molecules that probably are very, very polar.
Mm-hmm.
And once we had worked out the dissociation chemistry, then you could marry that into collision-induced dissociation. And then you're getting now a huge amount of information from one or several chromatographic runs. I mean, really, a lot.
Hmm.
And you could identify 40 or 50 nucleosides, different nucleosides, in one organism by doing that. Before, that would be a several years work.
Yeah.
But you never had to worry about the number of these things, because chromatography separated them. And even if they didn't separate them totally, you learn to read shoulders and everything else, and you can figure out where I was getting in trouble. So that was the story.
So when you electro spray these guys, did you have a... It seems to me, I recall a young woman working in Mike Gross's lab that was working with oligos, and she found them to be a challenge mass spectrometrically compared to the peptides and the protein things.
Yeah, probably so. They're still more polar than proteins and peptides.
And they seem to be prone to, you had to have a, she at least seemed to think that her viewpoint had a very pure, clean this equipment to do the wet chemical preparation and so on. You couldn't have any dirt around or else it would...
There's an element of that. It depends on what her problem was. Mm-hmm. If you're going to use enzymes to cut it up,
mm-hmm.
then you need to have things that are reasonably clean mm-hmm. before you add the enzyme.
Okay.
Because once they're hydrolyzed to small pieces, and you look at the pieces, you're not sure whether you're looking at something that came from a nucleic acid or a piece of junk.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or even a peptide or something like that.
So what when you went into these, what size, how many units did you start out with in these? Did you kind of get to bigger and bigger things with time? Or?
No, there wasn't any merit to it. We got to where we could. There is a very useful enzyme called ribonuclease.
Well, what?
T1. Ribonuclease, oh. That's one word. Two, the ribonuclease T1. And ribonuclease T2.
Mm-hmm.
It's a capital T in both cases.
Mm-hmm.
Usually done with a subscript T1, T2. And T2 is useful because it cuts only at G. So now think of a large nucleic acid. If you have an enzyme that cuts at G, since G is one of the four major bases, means that you're going to do a lot of cutting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you have stretches of nucleotides that don't have G's in them, you'll end up with some big pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But when you encounter that piece, you're fairly sure that the terminal nucleotide is a G. that's information.
Yeah.
That's information bearing. So, and... You can find modifications in there by various means, but if they're modified, that may be a really devil of a situation without LCMS.
Yeah.
I mean, LCMS is made for that sort of thing.
So you're continuing to push the state of the art in this whole time period, and also applying as much information as you can get from every possible...
The progress we made was very of decreasing importance in the field of mass spectrometry, but increasing importance in biology and people who deal with nucleic acids and the enzymes that make them, that modify them, and so forth. And because once you had electrospray, LCMS, and furthermore, if you did the experiment right, you could do CID on pieces that way. Mm-hmm. If you had enough sensitivity to do that, you've really got the bull by the horns, and I don't know what else you could do to develop something, trivial things. But then the action comes in what you're doing. What is the application you're then making with it? And so that's where the action is, and that's where the action was for me in most cases.
Now, I noticed in some of these papers, it seems like these are mostly Japanese collaborators that look at the list of papers and the authors. There's
a number of them.
There's quite a few, but I mean, they're from the Far East, but they're mostly, I mean, they're Japanese. They're not Chinese.
No, Japanese.
Yeah.
But they're not always in Nishimura's laboratory. There was another group headed by a man named Isono, I-S-O-N-O, Kiyoshi, K-I-Y-O-S-H-I, Isono. Those were antibiotics of various kinds, some of which were nucleic acid related, some of which were not.
Mm-hmm.
And we published papers, nice papers. And you would see a Japanese name, but it wouldn't have anything to do with the nucleic acid business or with the Nishimura group.
Mm.
So I probably published with him a dozen papers like that. I could count them.
Did any of those people come to your lab in Utah? Or?
To work, you mean?
Yeah, to work. Anywhere.
Occasionally. Oh, I had, yes, I had early on two postdocs that were from Japan who came. But they weren't the offspring or part of the groups of people I worked with otherwise. They just came on their own, and I supported them through grants and things like that. And we published a few papers, and they're gone. So.
Now, all this time you're being funded primarily by the
NIH.
And how is that level of funding working for you as a function of time? Is it constant?
It's fairly constant. It depends on whether you're asking for a mass spectrometer or not.
How many mass specs did you ask for?
If you're content with what you have, then the budgets obviously get much smaller.
Yeah.
If you've got a $500,000 mass spectrometer in the budget, then many things happen.
Yeah.
But it means that you're in a special category. So
how many, I mean, you had the 110 for starting in your research. Did you kind of fuck it up?
Then I had the 731.
Okay.
And we had an LKB.
Okay.
For conventional, was it conventional?
Was that a GCMS LKB?
It was mainly GCMS, right.
LKB 9000?
LKB 9000, 9000S it was called because it was made by Shimatsu.
Oh, it was done by Shimatsu.
Corporation. That's when they were in the business of using the patents provided by Viagra to make the
My understanding was that
interface.
Was that 9000 was fashioned after a mat machine, if I'm not mistaken. It was like a LKB's version of the mat 60 degree.
Well, that's what I heard, but I mean, 60 degrees is 60 degrees, so you can say. It's geometry that has use because of the optical, ionic problems that you have.
Yeah.
But saying that was copying someone, that's only true to an extent.
Yeah.
And I think probably that's right. But that's not a very versatile instrument, really. It was made for chromatography, mass spectrometry. You couldn't do CID with it.
The LKB was a single focusing?
Yeah. That was it.
Did you have anything to a higher resolving power than the 110, do you recall? Or?
Well, the 731 was higher.
751?
31.
31, 731.
The 731 was higher. So while the 110 probably, I don't know, is what they claim and is what you get. But if you if you say that on that instrument what you get is 25,000, then on the 731 you might get 50.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could do heroic things in both cases and move that up. But if you move it up very far, you're in a zone that's not practical because you have no beam.
Yeah.
The beam vanishes and you can't solve problems.
Yeah.
So, but still, the stepping stone would be to go from 731 to, I'm sorry, from 110, 21-110, to the MAT 731.
So the MAT 731, was that a Metallic Herzog?
Yes, it is.
With the photo plate detection and
With a focal plane.
Focal plane.
The ions arrive at a focal plane, not a point.
Yeah.
So you put a photographic plate in there if you've got a way to read the plate. We talked about this earlier. And that, was that the most sophisticated instrument we had?
Was that resolving power all that useful? A lot of the, sometimes this resolving power was a horse race type thing.
That's a very clever question. because the answer, as you probably know it, is no, it's not all that useful. But the fact is that when you really need resolution, you can get it much more easily.
Mm.
So if the max that you can get on an instrument is 50,000, whether or not you need 50,000 all the time, if you're running it at 12 and all of a sudden you need 30, you can get 30 pretty easily.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's where that's the story. But the resolution itself is not, has never been very important. The mass accuracy is what we found to be crucial because we worked so hard on converting mass to elemental composition. That was the cornerstone of doing the nucleic acid work.
So, but that was a fairly tight, you were constrained with a fairly small number of atoms, elements that you had to deal with. I mean, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, phosphorus.
Yeah, but what we did was, early on we wrote, we wrote programs that followed certain rules. And so you'd say that, okay, there is the largest, the minimum number of nitrogens in any nucleic acid is 2,
mm-hmm.
2 for your cell. So you cannot have a composition delivered by computer with fewer than 2.
Mm-hmm.
If it has ribose in it, you've got 4 oxygens.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you cannot deal with compositions with 2 oxygens. For example. And so you sort through, we published that, you sort through certain rules,
mm-hmm.
and it makes it much easier to separate the massive amount of junk that you get if you measure exact masses day and night, and not know which ones are important.
So your densitometer would convert all the information on the photoplate into just digital. Stick mass, like I mean, would it do the central
numbers? No, just numbers, really.
Just do the number tree.
Yeah. So it give you a list of numbers, and you can tell how you'd have a crude measure of the importance of the ion by its density
mm-hmm.
on the plate.
Mm-hmm.
So you get that's easy to get,
mm-hmm.
but then you make a. But I would say we didn't do very much of that with real mixtures.
Mm-hmm.
Very little, actually. We could have done more, but it was always such that we either had the wherewithal to purify it
mm.
or to ask a collaborator to purify it. That means that.
Did you get any collaborations at Utah and in the school there, or was the most, you were mostly collaborating with people outside of?
Outside the country, mostly.
Oh, wow.
No, in the department, almost never.
Mm.
In the university, almost never. Go through the
Peter's dying.
Yeah.
Peter.
I'm going to pick But, so that's kind of curious, that point, and it's been pointed out to me that, wow, you've got a whole career made up of collaborations with people elsewhere. If it was a collaboration, maybe many papers would have not.
Well, yeah, the Japanese connection was a couple of different places, and this fellow in Regensburg, Stetter, in the thermophiles, and so that's kind of a different kind of an approach to things.
But yeah. So the story of it with Regensburg and Stetter was that I learned from him about thermophiles.
Mm-hmm.
You can read if you want, but if you're working with somebody who's very enthusiastic and very knowledgeable, he's the number one man for many aspects of thermophily. Then, when that's... You don't need at some point to continue collaborating. You know what you learn what you do, and you can take the ball and run with it. And that's what happened with him. We had some things that we could have actually done together when I left Utah that we had planned to do, but we never got to. But
so what kind of projects did you take on after you were able to do on your own?
Oh, somewhat more of the same. We were interested in the effects of temperature of cell growth on modifications. Which ones and how much modification?
Mm-hmm.
I see temperature of cell growth, we're talking above 80 degrees, close to 100, or more than 100 even.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an interesting thing because there were such sharp differences when you get to big high temperatures. That's a problem. Most large molecules like DNA or proteins dissociate.
Mm-hmm.
It's like boiling water, right?
Yeah, right.
That's how you cook an egg.
Yeah, right.
But there are some organisms that are self-protected, and the enzyme, the proteins do just fine at 105.
That's weird.
Nucleic acids that do just fine at 100, 101, 102.
So what, I mean...
So the microbiologists view this as sort of phenomenological research. They've learned to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as a chemist, you say, well, not really the question if they've learned to do it. How do they do it?
Yeah.
What is the way they do this? And there's a lot of work done over a period of about 10 years, not in my lab, but around, trying to figure out how the proteins did it.
Mm-hmm.
And they made serious inroads into that problem. But it's not a simple question, and it's not, you know, they've learned to do it. Oh, how nice.
Yeah.
There's science behind this. What are the rules of chemistry? You break bonds at 100 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So how come you have an organism growing, smiling at you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the things I've come to the conclusion is that if there's a little bit of organic and a little bit of energy source, it'll create life of some kind or another. You know, I mean, there's all these things that grow in the dark. You know, they get their energy from a completely different place, and it's. It kind of says to me that there's life out there somewhere in the universe. Life.
Yeah.
You know.
That conclusion, I think, is a good one.
Yeah.
Plus, there's life. The other thing is the oceanography people will tell you that it's proving that there are boundless forms of life in the ocean. All kinds that you don't even know about.
Yeah, that's the scary part.
And so when you start saying, well, this is different and that's different, you're probably also talking not just about how it grows and so forth, but the enzymes they're used to put together, all the building blocks, those can be radically changed by temperature. So you're dealing with many things. So the complexity of the question increases greatly when you get up to 100 degrees. And we hardly know much about that.
So let's see here. You didn't have any much of an interaction with industry, I suppose. Government was mostly asking for dinero. And so I guess your decision to go where you went in your career was just guided by your own interests. And the fact that you went to academia was just the convenience of being able to pursue what you wanted to do.
That's right. And that I didn't appreciate that until later in life. It's really something to say that you want to do research and you have enough money to do it. But wait a minute, you work on what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Sooner or later, you have to justify it. Right? Mm-hmm. So the end of your grant, if you're supposed to do A, but you did B instead,
mm-hmm.
that's okay so long as you can show that that was a good thing to have done.
Mm-hmm.
And you, there, the strictures tightened up on you pretty much.
So did you have that occasion to have occasion for that to happen where you said, I'm going to do A, and then you end up doing B?
Not such that it would damage the fundability of the grant or something like that.
So you always kept the grant goal in mind, but you did stray whenever you saw something that looked a little bit interesting.
Yeah, oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. And that's how we got into the thermophile business mm-hmm. at the start. And that wasn't the thing that we had predicted or planned.
Mm. Were you able to get that funded in the thermophile work when you decided to go into it?
Well, that's one of the amazing things, is that when we really got rolling into the thermophile work, it was funded by NIH. There was no disease connection. None. None.
Hmm.
No. Cancer? No. Whatever.
That's interesting. It really didn't hook up with anything that you
No, had. But they recognized, I always thought that, you know, they recognized A, good science, and B, what we're learning about how molecules stabilize themselves here
yeah.
must also help when they're here.
Yeah.
Up
yeah.
here
yeah.
and down here.
The rules.
And
yeah.
I thought, gosh, that's has to be the case. That has to be why they put up with what we did. for so long, and then we became adept at it and produced a number of papers and so forth. So, let's see, what else do we need to worry about here?
I was curious.
We have tomorrow, don't forget.
Yeah, we have tomorrow. If you wanna, well, that's up to you. You know, I mean, if we want to carry on, it's there to use at least part of the day. I was just curious if you felt any time in your career were you particularly challenged, in the sense that this guy is kind of an outlier, and is he for real? Do we really want to support him, or do we want to really give him some credibility or some support?
There are no major issues along those lines. Once I broke loose of having to work on anything health-related,
mm-hmm.
I have a whole grant that almost has no health-relatedness mm-hmm. whatsoever. Once I and it got funded happily. Once I get into that situation, you've broken the bonds of
that connection.
Whatever, and you can feel good about it.
Yeah, I don't know if that would work in today's environment.
It may not. It works less and less, put it that way. I've talked to people about it, and it's less and less. Now the funding agency will say, wait a minute, this is National Cancer Institute.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this.
Yeah.
You can maybe make the case. There are places in the grant to do it. There are paragraphs that you write
mm-hmm.
talking about the relevance of what you're doing. And
well, yeah, you seem to have been in the right spot at the right time in terms of funding, because I think it's going to be a more and more critical issue with...
it's bad now. Yeah. Now it's really bad. Yeah. Oh, I'd hate to be an assistant professor these days, because...
I've got two people who are. I hear about it.
Yes. No, those are real... These are truly bad times for these people, because... the rules by which they operate require that they do research, and research requires money. Mm. So getting from here to there is not... Or you end up doing really mediocre stuff that you don't care about until all this blows over.
And yeah.
People take that attitude.
Well, or whether it'll blow over is
another issue.
If the government's going to be the big funder and it's up to debt, and it's... Well, I mean, regardless of what your political position is on it, the debt issue has to be resolved somehow. Mm-hmm. And one way to resolve it is not spend as much money.
Yeah, so that's a simple
part
way
of resolving it.
That's a simple way to do it. It's politically easier, but once you start saying, I'm going to fund here, but not here, you've opened up a real... Possibly opened up a can of worms.
So you really didn't do a whole lot of mentoring in your career. You had some
postdocs and graduate students. Yeah. We can make a list of them.
Were there any exciting moments in that whole process of mentoring these people, these younger guys? Do you have any issues with some of them? Or?
No, I mean, there are a range of success stories in students. A real range of success stories.
Uh-huh.
And some were highly successful, and some of the things they did were among the best things that we published. And others, it's the other way around, both for postdocs and for graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
When you get a good graduate student, you can do some of the very best work, because if they're smart and they're capable and you've got a good problem that you agreed on to work on, they can dig into the details much more effectively than a postdoc who's trying to get out in 8 years. And so the poor graduate student is there for the longer haul, and by and large you hope that this means that the depth that they can reach of understanding is greater. It doesn't have to be.
How many people went on to work in that nucleotide business after when they left your shop?
Worked for me?
Yeah.
Just a handful, probably three or four. And they all ended up in some location where they didn't have that luxury.
Mm.
I want to work on something to do with DNA. Well, maybe you can, maybe you can't. Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find out who's paying the bill. Let's find out if the question you want to work on has any real relevance to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I suspect to a lot of the students that then go on to get other jobs, they are puzzled and astonished by the realization that what they saw in their graduate career was unusual.
Mm-hmm.
In the paucity of constraints. Having a few constraints. Let's see, what else can I think of in here that's important? Advisory boards, nothing special. Lectures, nothing special. Living in Japan was an exciting thing, actually. And we were there for 6 months.
And then what period of your career? That fairly early, middle?
It was in 72 to 74.
72.
Yeah. It was mid-career. I'd already been. I was already a full professor, but I wasn't self-sustained that way. So. Sabbatical. I didn't take enough sabbatical leaves. That's always a problem for some people. They don't want to take sabbatical leaves because either they can't go away and manage what's at home.
Mm-hmm.
That's my big complaint.
Mm-hmm.
You lose track of managing what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that it just simply puts you too far away from things you're supposed to be dealing with.
Yeah, it would seem that it would kind of, I mean, in a way, I can see where it's a nice perk But then
it can be a nice break, put it that way.
Yeah,
that's okay. And sometimes it's in fact very helpful. But I was discouraged to see that some of my colleagues I know that they took sabbatical leaves for trivial reasons. What they did turned out to be nothing they could point to really on the curriculum vitae. Mm-hmm. Holy smoke.
Mm-hmm. So if you went, you did.
It's up to them.
Did you take a sabbatical to leave to Japan, or did you just do that on your?
Let's think about that for a minute. It's not so simple.
It was officially a sabbatical.
It was officially a sabbatical, but on the other hand,
half in Japan and half.
I was having trouble getting Baylor College of Medicine to pay for it.
Ah.
They didn't want to pay for it. For me.
So this was back when you were in Baylor.
Mm-hmm. Starting there, I was going to Japan the first time. Mm-hmm. And then that's when I went on sabbatical to Japan. What is it? The tail end of the Baylor experience. And so, I was also very naive and I didn't pay attention to the problems of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
You go on sabbatical leave, fine. Who's paying for it?
Mm-hmm.
You say, well, wait, what do you mean who's paying for it? Well, do you want a salary?
Mm-hmm.
Want to eat?
Mm-hmm.
Who's paying for it? Let's visit this very carefully.
Yeah.
So, people who work for state universities and have their salary paid with state money, so-called hard money, have a better time of it because whether they're paid here or they're paid there, if it's the same pay, roughly, then there's no big problem. But when they're grant supported, that's the difficulty.
I see.
Because when they're going away to some other place, the granting agency has to
buy in.
Concur.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you were, well, when you were at Baylor, Baylor was, an independent school, or was it part of a?
It's a private medical school.
Private medical. Okay.
And when I arrived, they had loose connections with Baylor University,
right.
Which is a private university. That didn't change anything. But they realized after a while that the being told by Baylor University that federal money was bad, get rid of it. We don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, to run a medical school, whoa. Federal money is the heart of how you get things done. And so finally, Baylor College of Medicine had to say to the other university, I think we're on different paths here.
Mm-hmm.
And they separated. That was while I was there. And the name didn't change, but you saw some changes in advisory boards and things at a really upper level. University administration. So it's a private medical school. One of, I think, three or four in the United States. It has no undergraduate affiliation.
Yeah, that's kind of weird.
It is. And that's why we felt so fortunate to be across the street from Rice.
Yeah.
And you had University of Houston not far away. And those are essential.
So there was enough recognition to the Baylor name that they wanted to keep that in the medical school, even after they split, they wanted to keep Baylor as part of the.
Oh yeah, I think they. Yeah, I think so. The medical school had and has a considerable reputation, and so the last thing they want to do is start over.
Come up with a new name. Yeah.
Oh, it creates all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
So they said, "Well, let's just quietly drop out of the Waco story."
So I guess the outsider doesn't realize that there are independent organizations even today.
The medical school.
Yeah, the medical school, because of the Baylor name, they just assume.
There are a few, and of course, the medical Baylor, most people would assume that Baylor College of Medicine is related to Baylor University. it ain't no more.
There was a Swedish couple who came who weren't married and were living together, and the Baylor people.
Well, that was one lady
who
was Evan Horning's chief person. mm-hmm. and she didn't like it. She told him to go get married, she told him.
Oh, yeah.
And quit singing. And they did, didn't they?
Yeah, and then they got divorced.
And they got divorced.
So there is this was, what, a graduate student or a lab person that was in the operation there?
I think it was a postdoc.
Ah, okay.
And this lady in Sweden comes in and sees sinning on a massive scale in America.
Mm-hmm.
All these people in this apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are not married, so she flipped over that. Well, let me try and find the Beeman.
Okay, I want to review my notes here.
Get that done.
Okay.
See what else. I can undoubtedly think of some things. I think we haven't talked about it.
Well, I was just curious about the 730. Did you have another instrument beyond that Matt 731?
No, what did we end up with? We shut down the 731. Oh, yes, what did we end up with? We ended up with a VG instrument.
Well, they had Zabs and...
This was the lesser of the Zabs.
I'm trying to remember the... But it was the vacuum generators.
I'll have to look at a grant. I've got a grant here I can go look at. Isn't that awful? I can't remember. Jeez. It was a... you'll know what it is the minute I mention it to you. Let me find a grant here.
So what?
Oh. Can you find me a... Utah grant? I mean, not a Utah grant. Yes, you talk
about. I'll see you again.
A recent one. See what I can find. Yeah. Okay. On the porch here is the audio file. In the ventry. Show you, and that might be when I do those tomorrow. It'll take me a few minutes to dump what I want.
You know what we could do is make a list of things that you can research between now and tomorrow, and then
and then
give you a chance to catch up on some of these details, and likewise for me. What's going on here?
So the largest molecule we worked with was probably ribosomal RNAs and one from Sulfurobus.
Ribosomal RNA?
Ribosomal RNA. That's different than transfer. tRNA means transfer RNA. Then ribosomal RNA is a different RNA. And in many ways, less is known about it, certainly about modifications. And so we got into that because we had, finally, the tools to work with something that big.
How big was it?
Well, 1,400 and some odd nucleotides.
Ooh.
Half a million, left or something like that.
That's getting up there.
Here you go, here's a picture of it. Pictures are cute.
Ouch.
Biologists love these. They love them.
It looks like a chemical engineering.
It's like an airport to me. Lost and found. Delta.
Uh, 1,400 nucleosides, you say?
Yeah.
So, was that, did you, I guess you had to...
There are ion tracks that you get with LC-MS. Whoa, the whole thing is a mess.
Yeah.
Three and four pieces underneath these. Lord knows how many under there, right? And, but you can separate out the tracks and assign meaning to them, usually, often.
So that ribosomal RNA, did you end up working with some enzyme to break
to
that?
Cut it down.
Yeah,
yes,
cut it out into pieces, yeah.
You have to. And it has to be a very reliable enzyme. You say, I'm going to cut it. I want to know the rules, and I don't want it disobeying the rules.
Yeah.
Because you make a lot of hay out of that.
VG70SEQ.
70-SEQ. That was retired. I bought it in 86, retired in 1997.
So these were kind of like sequential instruments and
yeah,
time?
Yeah, pretty much. You can tell by looking on.
You didn't have one of these shots where you got, you know, one of each laying around like Mike Gross has. I don't know. They buy my spectrometers like we buy candy bars, you know, in the med school there.
Well, I mean, this is from an R01. That's a personal brand.
Uh-huh.
And so, the API-3, you acquired 93, ion source DSI.
Okay.
The Micromass Quattro 2, 95.
That Quattro, was that a sector or a...
No, that's the...
They're quad, a triple quad.
Quattro. That's a triple quad, what
okay.
I'm saying. Yes. Purchased under this grant, that was purchased under a different grant, you see. Only 2 years apart. So I had two grants going, kind of leapfrogging each other. One was the cancer grant, and the other one was the non-cancer grant. Well, finally they looked at them and said, wait a minute.
What's that?
Then finally they looked at the two of
them
and said, wait a minute.
Okay.
I think we're... There's a shell here.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where the P is, but McCloskey...
There's a shell, but you know where the P is. Okay. Well, you know, I mean, you were doing science with this stuff. It wasn't like you were...
No. Yeah. No, I'm not.
You know.
I wasn't running a scan with a have no Ponzi schemes. No, so those are the instruments. That's okay. Yeah, but that's a good.
Yeah.
This is after the big instrument left after the Mat 731.
The 731 had been put to sleep
mm-hmm.
by then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what happened to those old instruments? Did you give them away, or did they just get
crushed? A lot of trouble when I got ready to go, because I didn't want to just mat any of them.
Uh-huh.
I had to give them away, and I went out of my way to find recipients
mm-hmm.
for them. And I did, as far as I can tell. Nobody reneged. I said, look, you want this instrument? Here is an active Vestek or whatever LCMS machine.
Mm-hmm.
If you want it, come get it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the address.
Mm-hmm.
Let me know when you're coming. And then you sign something. It's yours.
Mm-hmm.
It's yours, Jack.
So the school and the grant was okay with giving those away?
You purchased
the grant?
Yes, the end of its lifetime. At the end of its lifetime. And it knows how to, they know that's the case. Still looking for stuff in here. Specific aims, okay.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
The specific aims?
Yeah.
It was the heart, I guess.
Hyperthermophile.
Yeah, it's hot.
I like this.
Thermophile is 60 centigrade, and by agreement that'll take you up to about 80 or 85. And it's 85 to 100. That's hyper. That's a different world.
Pyrococcus furiosus.
I
like that name.
Instead of naming these things.
Let's scurry the longer side.
Oh, you love naming these things. Some of them are Latin words.
Did you ever have any of your grants rejected?
Yes. But never rejected.
Did be
whether you had a vulnerable priority score.
Okay.
I never had one that they said no, we're not going to rank it.
Okay, so
I had one that I had one time I think that didn't rank high enough to get paid. And so I resubmitted it.
So, but they never says this is garbage.
Yeah, that isn't.
Sometimes they didn't understand what he was doing. I think wouldn't that be case?
Well, in a few cases, that would chip away at the priority score. You get people looking at this and they say, "Wow, is this guy? What is this? He's doing?" And so I'm not going to give him my very best.
A physician once asked him if you could hook it up to a telephone.
To a what?
The mass spectrometer to a telephone.
So this is the one that was put back in. Original proposal submitted July 1st, 98. Reviewed fall, 98, by the Metallo Biochemistry Study Section. priority score of 254, percentile 36.1 was assigned. And 36.1 doesn't cut it. You need to be in the top 15 or 20%.
Yeah, I think that percentage requirement now has gotten a lot skimpier. Yeah, that was one of the points with Finn, is a lot of his grants got rejected because they were a little bit off the wall. He was an outsider. You know, he was trying to convince people to do these things and or fund this stuff, and he didn't have name recognition in the community. You know, and he was
I was involved in one of those reviews, and his grants, they were very applications were really. You know, he'd have a piece of something where he had done it with a pen and ink recorder and marked on it and sent it in. And it's not sophisticated. And so that counted against him, I think. It wasn't just the idea. You're thinking about the idea. But of course, later on, people said, well, the idea was gold. The idea was gold. How come you didn't give him any money?
I would like to conduct a study of all the papers and grants that are rejected that ended up being, you know, like the Munson, Field and Munson paper on CI, you know, that got scotched by somebody who was reviewing it and for Jack's. And Finn's research had a hard time getting accepted. All these things that, or real paradigm shifters and change the way the world views science and how it gets done.
Yes, indeed. I'll throw that back in you.
Yeah, you don't want to. Did you have a pretty good rapport with your instrument vendors? I noticed you had a little bit of everything. Did you go back to...
Good rapport. Of course, they all wanted to sell me more. No, we were never involved in any disputes like certain people. I won't name. You know, where you say, I'm going to sue you.
Did you have any interactions with Varoptic when you were, or is he already gone?
A little bit, just to say hi and...
So he was still in the faculty then?
Yeah.
Now, was he in the pharmacy?
He was in chemistry.
He was in chemistry, yeah.
Austin Varoptic.
A famous name. Well, he did a lot of his fundamentals and theoretical stuff and... early days.
And I, it was fun is to listen to him on a student thesis.
Oh yeah.
In many of these cases, he wouldn't understand really what the point was. The student.
Mm-hmm.
decades younger. But he would ask questions that had great substance to them. I thought I'd always like to have that.
Give the student a little bit of a run for their
money.
That
is fun.
Yeah.
I see what you're doing here. What do you think is the energy spread of the beam coming outside of here?
Whoa!
Let's talk about what determines the spread. Can you guess about what that would be? Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. So, I'm making a list for tomorrow.
Okay.
I'd like to show you a picture of the evolutionary tree.
Yes.
That we work from.
And I don't know if there's a website for those sticker size things.
Yeah, well, I can see about getting you the URL.
There's
that.
A publication that has
when
that.
When I ran it, when it was principally mine, got taken down.
Uh-huh.
When I gave it away, I gave the whole website away.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole bunch of people took it over. They added people to it and so forth and so on. And I just threw my hands up and said, guys, I'm getting ready to retire. I'm not going to mess with this stuff anymore.
I
need muscle in my arms to do this. That's missing.
It's the sliding around is the hardness.
It's also a problem.
It slides back and gives
you. Someday I'm going to fall bad because of that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've had some Lulu falls. Lulu's.
That's okay.
Right home about.
Yeah.
Did you find the place on Beeman?
Oh no, I have to look. It won't be hard to find.
Okay.
Let me bring too many things at once. Just let me get this mess straightened out.
Did you end up with a knee operation or?
That? No. That's just scraping. I'm falling down.
No, I mean, it looks like there's an incision or something on the side of your.
Oh, that?
Yeah.
No, you know, what is that anyway?
It looks like a.
Oh, that's where you had your leg across. That's just a
just getting old.
Indentation.
I've had kneecaps refurbed.
Oh wow!
With arthroscopy, with it.
Uh-huh.
Going to clean out the crowd. Those worked okay at the time. That's when I was jogging. The guy who does that stuff said, you know, your body's not built for jogging. I recommend that you stop and that you find another form of exercise. And that was after he had fixed one of them twice. And
you'd
once.
Had three arthroscopies.
Yeah, and so I said, I think this guy probably knows what he's talking about. This way he earns a living for me.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah, my boss at McDonnell Douglas was a jogger, and he had about multiple arthroscopic knee procedures over the years. He couldn't give it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's I found it to be kind of addictive. You get a little high going out and running around for a while.
That's what he said. He got a little buzz from it.
But if you're knees are collapsing. Can I look at the demon thing while you were doing that, Kay? I know you were doing something else.
Well, I was looking for the.
I don't have a demon thing on my computer, so I can't.
For the database.
Yeah. Did you ever have any patents?
Used some. None that worked.
Mm-hmm.
My name is on a couple of them from people in other departments.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, in fact, I didn't know existed until last week. I mean, I asked somebody, hey, what do you know about this? And I said, well, it didn't go anywhere. That's what I know about it. Okay. Oh, there you
RNA
go.
RNA modification
there. There you go. That's the current version.
Oh, wow.
Okay. The colors were from my era, made up by Jeff Rosinski, and so forth and so on. That's a shadow of its former self. I may be crazy for giving it up. I didn't want to mess with it anyway. Many hits. Many hits.
None of your work ever involved getting with industrial operations or collaborations?
No, no.
The pharmaceutical houses?
No. The only thing was I would go there occasionally to some of those guys and get talks or something, but that's not a...
Imagine it's probably. I've got the URL here. Do you want me to print out this page for you?
Yeah, print out the page. I mean, it's got the URL on it. You can go look at it.
Sometime. Yeah. Okay.
So here's the review after the review that wasn't good enough. This is the next one. And so, that's the usual format.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this, my understanding is the higher the score, the less likely it is to get funded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the percentile is all encompassing.
That tells you
that tells
pretty
you
much
where
it.
You are in the world.
Yeah.
So 13.8 is pretty good. I don't even today. I think that would get funded. Well, I don't know.
Yeah, things are tough.
Okay, here's that. This is the first page.
So. Oh, great. Thanks.
The URL is on there, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's at
the bottom.
It always prints off at the bottom.
Yeah. Okay. I'll keep that for my files. So this is the one that...
That's the one that they got funded after I sent it back in, see?
Mm-hmm.
It had a 34th percentile, and went back in and came up to 13, was it, or something like that.
So there's a lot of microchemistry in your approach to this, to these things.
Microchemistry?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The samples you're dealing with are all small, even before you cut them into smaller pieces.
Mm-hmm. Overall, a proposal must be much improved compared to the version previously submitted.
Does it say it is much improved?
No, it says overall it must be much improved compared to the version previously submitted. So it kind of suggests it still needs further improvement.
Hmm. They paid it though.
Yeah, this is one of the critiques from
one reviewer.
Reviewer, so.
You're on the right track. Keep going.
You know, I'm wondering, will this, they might want just a link to the full text of this for the library. That's what I was thinking, rather than a print copy. Will that be possible?
for...
GMs.
Yeah, I think that there will be... I mean, if he's willing, then the oral history would go up on the Internet, on the ASMS website, and would be also available from the CHF website. So from that person, and a PDF file could be supplied, like Beeman's... PDF, you know, we got a copy of Beeman's PDF file, the transcript, so, but I mean, it's a lot, another thing would be to have, if there is a hard copy bound book that will be the transcript, and all the supporting documentation that goes into it, so I mean, that'll be, you'll get a copy, and ASMS gets a copy, and the CHF library gets a copy, because they've got a collection of these transcripts from the various people, scientists from all kinds of fields of chemistry, and the mass spec part is our little, you know,
thing the world
together. Yeah. So, but I think it would be nice for the library to have a copy to put on the shelf, and then, you know, people can find it that way if they're... I guess everyone is going to be web-wise in the future, but, you know, who knows, maybe... It
should be.
Should be.
I mean...
Well, here, this should go to Joan Stoddart, Deputy Director.
Okay.
And then here's the address down here.
And we can make sure that happens.
I'll send her.
It'll be a while before it shows up,
yeah.
So.
Yeah.
She may retire before you. She gets
she may. She may very well. She's going on far down right.
She is.
So by revising that proposal, it was kind of rejected, but not. It was you were kind of encouraged to resubmit it. I guess is what I.
Yeah.
What I got from
yeah.
it.
And yeah.
So that
the review of the one that didn't get funded was kind of interesting to read. The minute they start saying anything negative, the priority score starts going down. If you start your review with, this guy is a terrific scientist, but you've sealed his fate.
But.
You've sealed his fate.
Well, you were able to work that game pretty well over your career. So, if you get one resubmission, that's not exactly a
not too bad. No. Not too bad.
So, there's not a lot of people doing this kind of mass spec in this nucleoside-nucleotide arena today, is it? Down to a handful, or
no? It's a handful, and they're usually spread out, and you can't tell them what. They're not focused like this is. This is focused on.
Yeah, I mean, everybody seems to be into the proteomics or some kind of omics, you know, proteomics or glycomics or whatever omics, and not a lot of interest, I guess. And I don't know why. Is it maybe it's too difficult to mess with?
Well, the omics. Thing is, has become famous.
Yeah.
And see, does this go somewhere?
Well, I don't know if we want to carry on with some of these other. Issues now, or you want to try and find something in particular? It's up to you.
Yeah, I wanted to find you some things out of that would be out of really recent reprints or wrapped up. We had that on the web. Yeah.